If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440. Or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema. All lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content. So if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 74. My name's Terry Frost. And how the hell is everybody? Yes, I have a new intro there. I've been tweaking a few classic movie clips into some form of an intro with a bit of a waka-chicka-waka-chicka guitar riff line underlying it. Just thought I'd change things up a little bit. Let me know what you think. Things here have been fine. Tomorrow, actually, is my birthday. Yes, I have racked up yet another year without dying, and that's a positive thing. Tonight, we're going out to dinner with friends. Tomorrow, I'm going to go out with Sal, and we'll go for a drive in the country or something like that. And Monday, I'm going to spend the whole day at the cinema, which is never a bad thing. So, yeah, things are fine here. I've already got one of my birthday presents, which is probably one of the grooviest presents I've ever got, which is an Amazon Kindle ebook reader. And the reason why it's so groovy, apart from the fact that it's incredibly thin and it's hand-sized and it does the job extremely well, is the fact that I have David Thompson's new biographical dictionary of cinema on it. Now I can search it. So if I need to have any kind of movie reference, I've got this thin little sliver of a thing, rather than schlepping around the enormous books that I used to do for the podcast. So I'm trying to get some form of a podcast reference library on my Kindle. And if you haven't played around with one of these things, definitely try it. There's a lot of stuff out there, and it's cheaper than buying the hardcovers or the paperbacks, of course. But really, really enjoying the technology, really enjoying playing around with it. And it goes with me everywhere. So that was a birthday present from Sal. She also gave me a voucher for a whole bunch of Amazon.com ebooks. So, yeah. Loving that as well. So, what have I been watching? I'll just bring up my Mizo again and we'll have a look at it for you. Oh, before I do, I'll tell you what movies we're doing this time around on the podcast. I'm kind of going from the 1940s to the 1990s. Now, remembering the 20-year rule that I have for Paleo Cinema, I can slip in a movie from 1991 these days. And there's a movie that I've wanted to talk about but haven't been able to previously, and that one is Cast a Deadly Spell, starring Fred Ward, David Warner, and Julianne Moore. It's an HBO movie that was shown on television very early in HBO's career as a purveyor of fine fiction in movies and series. And I really like it. It was directed by Martin Campbell, who directed Casino Royale, the most recent version, amongst other things, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. The other movie I'm doing is another one that I've wanted to do for a while for the podcast, and it's one of the finest British films of the 1940s, and possibly and arguably the best British film noir ever. It's 1948's Odd Man Out, starring James Mason and directed by Carol Reed. I really want to talk about this one because every time I watch it, I get emotionally affected by the film. And I really do have a lot to say about it, hopefully. So, and now back to what I was watching. I saw a thing called More Dead Than Alive. I think Dr. Zom flagged this one. It's a 1960s Western starring Clint Walker, who people might remember from the Cheyenne TV series, and Vincent Price. It's a very odd Western, and it has something of a downbeat ending, but I kind of like it. It's one of those movies where you see the filmmakers trying for a certain effect, not quite always succeeding, but really kind of, it's a little bit episodic, going through the life of a reformed gunfighter. But it's not a bad little watch there. I don't mind watching that at all. And check it out if you've got the time to. Not a fantastic film, but worth your time, in the sense that not worth too much more than your time, but an interesting little one to see. And the odd thing about it is that there's some really weird soundtrack music at various dramatic points of the movie, where you think, what the fuck did they use that music at that point of the movie for? But I'll leave that, you discover that yourself. I did watch Fathom, starring Raquel Welch, one more time, because I wanted something kind of mindless to watch, which had pretty women in it. And that, it's a kind of 60s spy thing with Raquel Welch, who could never act, but always looked fantastic. Let's see, I did see Sharky's Machine, the Burt Reynolds directed Burt Reynolds movie from 1981. Terrific jazz soundtrack to it. It's got Burt in it. Let's see who else is in it. It's got Rachel Ward, who's now married to the Australian actor Brian Brown. She lives in Australia at the moment and is starting to become a movie maker on her own, in her own right these days. Charles Durning's in it, amongst other people. It's got Vittorio Gassman in it. And it's kind of like a post 1980s version of Laura, in a weird kind of fucked up way. But not too bad. I did see Black Swan, and I can see the expertise in it, and I'm not sure Natalie Portman deserved the Oscar. I mean, I'm not sure she gave everything she had to the movie, but there's an emotional disconnect for me between Natalie Portman's character and me. It's an interesting film, and it's a movie that's kind of more in a Cronenbergian genre than has been led on by some other people. But, it's a little bit kind of like Polanski's Repulsion as well. But I think Aronofsky's an interesting director, but the movie didn't blow me away the way it did a bunch of other people. I haven't watched a hell of a lot of movies in the last 2 weeks, so I'll just go with a couple more that I have watched. I did see Pulp Fiction again. I watched that again on Blu-ray and on my Blu-ray copy, and I love it. I love the structure. I love the pacing. I love the dialogue. I think the acting's great. And I always like watching Uma Thurman dance. So I watched that. I looked at a bunch of the extras as well in various little bits of time. And the other one I watched is one that I know is a favourite of Brian over at the Hammockers podcast, Darby O'Gill and the Little People. It's a Disney film from, I think, about 1959, starring Janet Munro and Sean Connery in one of his first kind of leading roles. And yes, it's got the kind of Irish cliche, leprechauns and banshees and pots of gold and jewels and all sorts of things like that. But it's got that kind of inner emptiness that too many Disney movies have. It tries to be, yeah, a magical, fantastic film, but it's kind of a bit plastic and hollow. I did see also a fun film from the 1940s, directed by Renee Clair, a movie called I Married a Witch, starring Frederick March and Veronica Lake, which is a lot of fun to watch. It's a kind of light, fluffy thing about basically a guy who marries a witch who has cursed his family from hundreds of years ago. Yeah, it's cute, and I may do it in a podcast in the future at some stage. May not, but I may. And we'll just wait and see how that goes. I won't tell you too much about it, but if you get a chance to watch it, it is a little bit of fun. It's got some cute special effects. Cecil Kellaway's in it, amongst other people. Susan Hayward's in it. So, yeah, check that out. And I watched the two movies for the podcast, of course. And the other thing I should mention, too, is I'm back doing the movie things for ABC Darwin. We had a bit of a disconnect for a few weeks there, because the normal time we do it is Friday nights, and during the football season they're broadcasting football games on ABC local radio in the Northern Territory on a Friday night. So Ivor and I kind of talked it around by email a little bit, and now we're doing it Thursday nights instead. He calls me up Thursday during the daytime. I sneak into a little office at work. We talk for 20 minutes about movies. I sneak back out again, and we move on with it. So we did a talk last week about The Naked Jungle, which I did recently on a podcast, and it went over well. The interesting thing about that is, and this is purely a coincidence of Tommy, it wasn't marketing or anything like that. We talked about it on Thursday, and it's showing on ABC television, the national broadcaster, the government broadcaster. It's showing on television on ABC 2 tonight, Saturday night. So it was interesting that we could actually talk about a movie that's going to be shown on the same network of broadcast functions. ABC does radio, it does television, it does podcasts, it does internet stuff, it does all sorts of things. It does international programming in foreign languages for overseas. So it was interesting to connect up between ABC 2 and ABC local radio in Darwin and just talk about a movie that was upcoming on the other platform. And that was a bit of fun. I always like talking with Ivor. It's great. Next time around, Thursday next week, we're doing Angel Face. I talked about that in an earlier podcast as well. The film noir directed by Otto Preminger, starring Robert Mitchum and Gene Simmons. Not the Kiss Gene Simmons, the other one. So enjoying that a lot too. It's a good discipline for me. It's a lot of fun. And as I may have said before, I'm not sure, I really do enjoy being a part of the national broadcaster, the national government broadcaster. I like contributing to the kind of zeitgeist, in a way, of national broadcasting. And it's an extension of what I do with the podcast, really. It's just hipping people to movies they might not otherwise like, having a chat with Ivor, who's incredibly easy to talk to, and we just groove on the movies and pass on the information to people, and I really do enjoy that. And so yeah, anyway, on with the podcast. I'm going to take a little bit of a break in a couple of moments, and we'll get on with the first movie. We're going to talk about Cast a Deadly Spell, the HBO movie directed by Martin Campbell, starring Fred Ward, David Warner and Julianne Moore in one of her earlier roles. Yeah, but before I do that, we do have a lot of feedback this time around too. I've got at least four voicemails, which is always welcome. We're getting some interesting people downloading the podcast in obscure places as well. We've actually cracked Hawaii, which is great. So mahalo to the people in Hawaii. Getting a few more people in Asia, Southeast Asia particularly. Malaysia are getting a little bit of interest there. Indonesia, so hi to everybody in there. China, Japan. I'm not sure how good your English is in those places, but I'm making assumptions there, so I apologize if it's a bit rude to make the assumptions. But I love the fact that you're listening, and please continue to do so. And if you'd like to, just send me feedback. At the front end of the podcast, Sal says where the feedback goes to, and I'd always like to hear from people in slightly unusual places. Doesn't have to be long, but if anybody wants to just touch base with us and let me know what you think of it, that'd be great too. Anyway, I'm going to take a break. Now, the first bit of music I'm going to play in that little hiatus between me clearing my throat and going for a piss is from a musical version of a stage play written by Bud Schulberg, who we remember from the podcast I did about A Face in the Crowd. He wrote the movie A Face in the Crowd. And the movie, the music is from the musical version of What Makes Sammy Run, which is about a TV and movie executive. It's set in the 1950s. If you do a bit of a Google search, you'll get a bit of an idea what it is. But I first heard this song. On the piano was Richard Rodney Bennett, the guy who had composed the music for Billion Dollar Brain. He was in Australia, and he played the piano while, I forget who the singer was, but a female singer sang this song, and I heard this in the 1970s. The song stuck with me a bit because it's a little bit rude, but the song's called The Friendliest Thing, and this is from the original soundtrack. It's an actress called Bernice Massey from the original soundtrack of What Makes Sammy Run.
Drinks are one way to break the ice. Dancing, they say, is all so nice, but why delay? The friendliest thing two people can do, since you are free, no strings attached, and you're like me, no wings attached, then this can be the friendliest thing two people can do. You love to take and boast of it. I love to make the most of it. Why do we fake the friendliest thing two people can do, when it's the sin that's sweetest, and no doubt the indiscreetest and friendliest thing two people can do.
And I'm back. I like that song. It's kind of nice and sexy and bluesy and kind of torch songy. So really enjoyed that one. So on to the first of the two movies, Cast a Deadly Spell from 1991. I'll just go through the cast and crew and things like that, and then we'll talk a little bit about it. It was directed by Martin Campbell, who has directed a couple of James Bond films. And started his career doing softcore porn. He started out with a movie called The Sex Thief, starring David Warbeck, who people might remember from some Italian action films. And then went on to do a few other things, and eventually ended up doing Casino Royale and kind of rebooting the James Bond franchise in great style. The producer was Gail Ann Hurd, who was a producer on the original Terminator as well. And if you check out Gail Ann Hurd's filmography, you'll see that she's been very influential in genre works for the last 25-30 years. She really is kind of an unsung eminence Greeks in the genre. It was written by a guy called Joseph Doherty. It stars Fred Ward, Julianne Moore, Clancy Brown's in it, the guy who played the Kurgan in Highlander, and most people would know him for that, David Warner, and Charles Hallahan. Let's see what I got there. So, blah, 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 blah. Got a whole bunch of stuff here, so I'm just going to go through that. Now, to get this going, my Kindle has to turn sideways, so I've got to kind of do it long way. So I'll give you the plot that I've got from Wikipedia on this one. Fred Ward stars as a 1940s hardboiled detective, Philip Lovecraft, in a fictional universe where magic is real. Monsters and mythical beasts stalk the back alleys. Zombies are used as cheap labor. And everybody except Lovecraft uses magic every day. Yet cars, telephones, and other modern technologies exist in the world. So basically, he is hired by a guy called Amos Hackshaw, played by David Warner, to find a missing book that was stolen from Hackshaw's place by his chauffeur, a guy called Larry. And the book happens to be the Necronomicon, which, if you know your Lovecraft Cthulhu mythology, is the big book that summons the old ones back to Earth. And nothing good ever happens with people who piss around with the Necronomicon. So Fred was playing Lovecraft. Of course, that's a reference to H.P. Lovecraft, the guy who invented the whole Cthulhu mythology. Did things like the story that became the Dulwich Horror, which, of course, starred Dean Stockwell. It was done by Roger Corman back in the day, back in 1970. So, you know, just basically all that kind of groovy backstory exists for this one. And if you're going to get somebody to play a 1940s private eye, Fred Ward's not a bad person to go to. He's an ex-boxer. He was a bouncer in a bordello at one stage. And, he's got a smashed-looking mug, and he's got that very much 1940s look about him. And he's a genuine tough guy, so he's perfect for the role of Phil Lovecraft, the detective. The whole story setup's a little bit like the setup for The Big Sleep. You know, you've got a rich guy who's got a sexy daughter and whose chauffeur is missing. So it's got a little bit of a similarity there to The Big Sleep as well. And Lovecraft meets up with an ex-girlfriend of his, Connie, who is now the girlfriend of Harry Borden, the nightclub owner, played by Clancy Brown. And of course, Harry Borden, the nightclub owner, is interested in the Necronomicon, getting the Necronomicon back for his own reasons. He has a sidekick, a short, dapper guy called Mr. Tugwell, who's very good at magic. And also, Harry has around an enormous black guy, a zombie, as kind of his bouncer come bodyguard. So Lovecraft and Connie kind of still have a spark for each other, and Julianne Moore in this looks stunning. Long reddish hair. She gets to lip sync a couple of nightclub songs, and she shows the chops that she, of course, has as an actress. Very fine actress, apart from the fact that I got the hots for her. But in this one, she is particularly sexy, and she's perfect as a femme fatale. She's very much a 1940s femme fatale, and the plot goes from there. This film's beautifully structured. It's really a top piece of work on a limited budget, but with a lot of imagination. There are a bunch of other people in the film who are very interesting as well. There's an actress called Anisha Walker playing Hippolyta Kropotkin, who is the landlady of Phil Lovecraft, and is also happens to be a witch and runs a dance studio. So she's she gets some very good lines. I remember Anisha Walker from Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, one of Paul Bartel's movies, which may end up on a podcast at some stage. I've got a fondness for it. It's kind of like a Douglas Sirk sex comedy almost, which is a very weird and interesting little piece of film if you can get a copy of it. And the music for this actually won a couple of awards. It's a very fine piece of music, and the soundtrack's by Kurt Sobel. And for something which is essentially a TV movie, the production values are very good. Now, when I say the production values are very good, you've got to remember this is about 3 years before Jurassic Park came out and CGI came in as the go-to technology for special effects. This film didn't have the luxury of being made 3 years later. The special effects are all physical effects. And when the old ones eventually do come back, from our viewpoint in this, in setting into the second decade of the 21st century, some of the special effects aren't as good as they would have been had the movie been made a decade later. But I'm forgiving of it because the acting is very good. Clancy Brown's pretty cool playing the kind of role Brian Don Levy would have played in the 1940s. And David Warner's David Warner, pretty much, he's one of those guys who catches a lot of chicks. And why not? I mean, he moved to Hollywood from England and made himself a career playing older, slightly eccentric characters. And, of course, Fred Ward. I've got a lot of time for Fred Ward. I mean, Tremors, Henry and June. He's a guy that can go from working on the right stuff to working on something like Cast a Deadly Spell and still really has a solid presence and a lot of charisma to him as well. And in fact, Fred Ward and Julianne Moore have worked for the same director. They're both in Robert Altman's Shortcuts in 1992. And of course, Fred Ward plays part of the comic relief in Robert Altman's The Player, made in 1994. So they've all both worked with the same guy in the same movie twice. So anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of audio from Cast a Deadly Spell and come back and just kind of wrap it up. This is, it's one of those ones that is a little hard to find. I think it may be, I know it was on VHS in Australia, and I used to have a copy of it there. It's available from some torrent sites, and I think it maybe came out on DVD in Australia very briefly at some stage. I'm not too sure, but you can find it if you look around. But anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of the voiceover from Fred Ward, and then I'm going to play the interview bit between Fred Ward and David Warner.
But what I walked into after I left that night made all the magic and witchcraft I'd seen up to then look like a sideshow. My name's Lovecraft, and I'm the guy who knows. Just about the only guy who knows it all. And you're still breathing. It started that night, and it started with a woman. It always starts with a woman.
Didn't like the way Willis was looking at her. I thought removing him from the property would be enough, but I underestimated the young man. He took something with him when he left.
What?
A book. An old book.
Valuable.
Oh, the fittings and bindings might be worth a few thousand. It does, however, hold great sentimental value for me.
What kind of book was it?
A treatise on certain kinds of esoteric magic. It's called the Necronomicon. It's about the same size as a large photograph album, bound in leather, finished in gold, and I want it returned quickly.
How quickly?
I want it in my hands by Thursday. I'm attending a conference, and this volume is the key to my presentation.
Well, that's the day after tomorrow.
No later than midnight.
A conference that starts at midnight?
Look, if you don't think you're the right man for the job...
Now, what's this Willis look like?
Thin, 5'10", 5'11", sandy hair.
Old?
Not old, 26.
Did he live here?
No. Meadows can give you his address, but according to his landlord, he hasn't been there for days.
Well, it's a place to start.
What are you going to cost me, Lovecraft?
$40 a day, plus gas and reasonable expenses. Yeah, you can get cheaper, but you can't get better. And if you're looking for someone with an edge, the phone book's full of detectives who use magic and witchcraft.
No, you're the man for the job.
Retainer's customary. 100 will do. Probably spend more than that on goldfish for your squid.
It is not a squid.
That it is not a squid line is an interesting one because it's just left as it is. The implication for people who've kind of hip to Lovecraft as a genre is that the thing in the tank is maybe a messenger from the old ones, because they all tend to be a bit squamous and squid-like and things like that. So, there's a few little Easter egg-y kind of things in the movie like that. And it really is a film. It's very well directed. The art direction also for the... They've got a nightclub. The nightclub's called the Dunwich Room, which again is a little bit of a nod towards H.P. Lovecraft. But the art direction is fantastically good. The period feel of it is impeccable. There are a number of different places. There's a little diner where certain things occur, which are in some ways a bit of a nod towards Night of the Demon. There's the nightclub. There's Lovecraft's office, which is also where he lives, of course. And a few other set places, which there's also a kind of homage to Chinatown. Actually, not Chinatown. Let me just kind of work out my timelines on this. Yeah, maybe. Let me just check something for you. I think I know something about this, which might kind of be a bit of a hip thing. Wait a second. Yeah, got it. Sorry, I had a bit of a mind flash there. There is a homage to the sequel to Chinatown, The Two Jakes, which came out a year earlier, where there's some scenes in a 1940s housing estate, which is kind of interesting as well. It's a very knowing film, and it's very knowledgeable about the two different genres, horror and kind of film noir, crime, gangstery, private detective stuff, that the film kind of cross-pollinates. And for that reason, I think particularly people who are science fiction and speculative fiction fans are going to really enjoy this film if they haven't seen it before. I know a number of people have. I know, for instance, my friend Danny Oz definitely knows this film and treasures it. And it's just a groovy little flick. It's not a big one. The budget wasn't big, but the stars in it are fantastic. And it's quality work. It really is. There was a sequel made to it as well called Witch Hunt in 1994, but they didn't get Fred Ward to star it. They got Dennis Hopper. And it's set in the 50s and involves magic involved with the House Un-American Activities Committee and a Senator McCarthy type who, in this case, was played by Eric Bogosian, which is kind of an interesting film, but it's not as successful as the original. It's not shabby by any means, but I really think the original and the 1940s lends itself to this kind of alternate reality magic kind of thing better than the sequel set in the 1950s. But again, it's got Dennis Hopper in it, which is interesting, but not Dennis Hopper at his best. Eric Bogosian. It's got a transvestite entertainer in it called Lip Sinker, who runs a brothel. And, for that reason, it's kind of, they do kind of work well together, the two films, Witch Hunt and Cast a Deadly Spell, but Witch Hunt being the lesser of the two films. I do like this kind of stuff. I really think there should be more of these kind of alternate universe, playing with reality things where you can jump genres and have homages and kind of meta-texts to other works and things like that in it. It's the kind of thing Kim Newman does in all of his fiction, but this is done in a somewhat different format. And check it out if you can. It's one of my, it's not really a guilty pleasure, but it's like a, there's got to be a new kind of term for this. It's not guilty because I don't feel guilty about watching anything. I'll watch pretty much anything. I'll watch a Bukkake film and then go and watch Bergman. But one of the, there's got to be a term for those kind of movies that aren't incredibly deep but have a little bit of nuance to them and are just something you watch for enjoyment. The Naked Jungle's in the same thing. It's just one of those fun films that you watch for the sheer fun of cinema. And this one, even though it's a TV movie, I watch for the sheer fun of it. I'm going to have to work out a term for this because my brain is failing me on this. I don't like guilty pleasures because guilt as a concept isn't one that I really do take to. I think it's got too many theological connotations for where my personal head is at. But anyway, one of the films to see. I know it's available on CG for the people who know what CG is. And sorry if I'm being obscure there because unfortunately I have to. But I think you can also find it on BitTorrent if you want to look around. If it is available on DVD, I recommend you get it on DVD because the sharper and more legally you can acquire something, the better. But if it's not available legally, of course, people are going to do it by other means. And that's the nature of the 21st century in a way. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now and get on with the second film, which is a much more serious and deeper work. Odd Man Out from 1948, directed by Carol Reed, starring James Mason, Robert Newton. It's also got Dan O'Hurley here in it and Cyril Cusack. So another break now. What music? Oh, I did have some more music set up here. What am I going to play? Give me a moment. I know. I'm going to play Gene Pitney. Because I found out that someone downloaded the podcast in Hawaii, I thought I'd find a song about Hawaii just to honour that. And here it is, Gene Pitney singing Hawaii.
Palm trees reach out to the sky up above, sipping and swimming in a wonderland of love.
Hawaii, holding hands on the sand of Hawaii, Maui'i and me, and
I remember.
Okay, on to the second movie, which is Odd Man Out, a British film from, he said, finding the date, I think it's 1947, I apologize, I was thinking 1948. This is an Irish film noir directed by Carol Reed, starring James Mason, and it's based on a novel of the same name by F.L. Green, who also contributed to the screenplay. Let's see the plot. The film's opening intertitle reads, "This story is told against a background of political unrest in a city of Northern Ireland. It is not concerned with the struggle between the law and a legal organisation, but only with the conflict in the hearts of people when they become unexpectedly involved. The city and the illegal organisation is never explicitly named in the film, but the protagonist is a chieftain in an IRA-like organisation, Johnny McQueen, played by James Mason, who is trying to escape from the police after an ill-advised mill robbery meant to replenish the organisation's coffers. The film follows McQueen, who has been wounded in the robbery, through an increasingly surreal odyssey over a day and a night. The bleak city, almost certainly Belfast, with its labyrinth of havens and traps, draws Johnny ever deeper into itself as the night wears on." So, you know, James Mason was a pretty well-known English actor, and after this film, he went over and did films in America as well. Of course, he was in A Star Is Born, and he did North by Northwest as the villain. He was Captain Nemo in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Did a whole bunch of different things, and but this is the kind of real career kicker that James Mason had. So the supporting cast were drawn. There were a lot of supporting casts were drawn from Dublin's Abbey Theatre. Among the other members of the organisation in the movie are Cyril Cusack, the father of Sinead Cusack. Cyril Cusack, good character actor. Robert Beatty and Dan O'Hurley, who people might remember from, was the old corporate head in RoboCop. In his travels, Johnny meets an opportunistic bird fancier, played by F.J. McCormick, a drunken artist, played by Robert Newton, a barman, played by William Hartnell, the person who was the very first Doctor Who. And his girlfriend, a character called Kathleen, was played by an actress called Kathleen Ryan. And she's very good in this movie, too. She's the kind of emotional heart of the film in a lot of ways, and is ultimately the character in the film who leads to the tragic ending of the movie, and whose actions and whose emotions are the kind of generator for a lot of what goes on in the latter half of the film. The cinematographer was a guy called Robert Krasker, and it was his first film for Carol Reed. And the lighting sets were designed by Ralph Brinton and Roger First. And to be honest with you, this film has a terrific look about it. All the walls are kind of mist covered, and the streets are the usual film noir streets. It's made more interesting by the fact that there are still hansom cabs around. There are trolley buses crammed full of people. And it really does go into a lot of detail and a lot of care to evoke the city itself as one of the characters in the movie. And part of the film is seen from an objective eye, and part of it, there are a couple of scenes where Johnny, who is not well even before the robbery, there's something wrong with him, some kind of medical condition, which leads to dizziness and blurred vision, amongst other things. And Johnny has a few surreal episodes where he sees people's faces in the kind of bubbles of a spilt beer and other things like that. So part of it's from his viewpoint, and part of it's from a more objective viewpoint. And again, this is this could have been done as an action film or a chase film. There are some extremely effective action scenes as well, but in general this is very much a character piece, and it's all in the writing and the acting for this. I'll play a little bit of the audio from the track. Now this is where Johnny, after staggering away from the robbery, he tries to get in the getaway car, but they can't quite pull him into the car, and he falls out of it and then staggers away. And Cyril Cusack, playing the getaway driver, is just too chicken shit to go back and pick him up. Which ultimately, you know, leads to Johnny hiding out wherever he can and finding a haven wherever he can while he's wounded and dying for that day and a night in, we'll assume it's Dublin or Belfast or somewhere like that. But one way or the other, Cyril Cusack's cowardice is the trigger for what occurs to Johnny afterwards. Now, Johnny's taken haven in an old air raid shelter. This is just after the war, and there's still air raid shelters around. and he's hallucinating. He thinks he's back in the prison cell that he escaped from before the robbery took place. And he thinks he's talking to a prison officer, but he's not. I'm not going to tell you who he's talking to. You've got to see the movie to know that. But this is kind of Johnny talking about what's occurred.
Oh. What an outing. I dreamt I'd escaped from prison. I dreamt I was on a raid, robbing a mill, funds for the organization. I remember I wasn't feeling so good. I hadn't felt so good ever since I'd escaped from here. After we'd done the job, there was a fight, and I shot a man. Yes, I dreamt I shot him. And I couldn't get onto the car. Somehow I couldn't get onto it. That's right, I was wounded in the left arm. I fell off and got up and ran along streets, afraid I'd killed him. And then I came to an air raid shelter, slumped down. I must have passed out.
And, of course, Johnny is in that air raid shelter. He thinks that reality is a dream and his illusions are a reality. And that's the interesting thing about this film that I found. It's incredibly non-judgmental. Johnny never actually finds out that he killed the man in the robbery. He knows he wounded him. But nobody actually tells him that he's a murderer. And that's an interesting way to play it, too. There's everybody has their own character traits. The people he was in the robbery with, one of them is a coward, the other two are scared young men who really don't know where things are heading and realize that events are out of their control after the robbery. And a couple of them go looking for him, and each character has their own arc and their own comeuppance, in a sense, as a kind of side issue to Johnny's story as he staggers through town. Now, there's the only really dull note in this movie, and it's an incredibly vivid film, and the writing and the acting is breathtakingly good. Everybody seems to be exactly who they are. Ordinary people show immense courage and compassion. Some others show deceit and treachery and an ability to lie very effectively. Some of the police are bastards. Some of them are sympathetic within the constraints of the law. And there's an incredible, intense humanity to this film, which is at the core of it. The fact that politics and bad choices create events that kind of spiral out of control. And again, this is the essence of film noir, that the fact that a mistake leads to tragedy through the actions of the person making the mistake and also the actions of those around them. This is very much a film noir set in Northern Ireland, which makes it a very rare bird indeed. And I can't think of another film that has this kind of story arc where the protagonist, even before the robbery, is probably dying of something, some kind of brain injury or some kind of problem, which is only exacerbated by the events of the film. It's a little like DOA, where you know almost from the start that the tragedy is about to occur to the main character. But, you know, events have got to play out before that end is brought to. DOA is somewhat different, where the businessman's poisoned and has to find out who poisoned him before he dies. That movie with Edmund O'Brien has a different arc to this. This one, it's Johnny trying to find sanctuary and trying to escape, and events and the agendas of the people he meets conspires against that. I mean, he meets all sorts of weird characters. The foul note on this one is really Robert Newton playing the mad artist. I don't think he's on the same page as everybody else. He's a little too over the top and a little too unrealistic and a little too flamboyant for this kind of movie. He really does take people out of the film a little bit by drawing just that too much attention to his own acting, which, you know, if the movie has that one flaw, it can definitely be forgiven, because that does seem to be the only real big flaw that this film has. The black and white cinematography is incredibly vivid. The deep shadows with just that touch of a watery highlight on them. The air raid shelters and the alleys and the pubs where the mad artist has painted the wall in return for drinks, and the way the publican, played by William Hartnell, acts exactly like a publican would in these circumstances and not the way we expect them to in a movie. The compassion of two ladies, I think they might be sisters, waiting for the husband to get home, and suddenly they find on the street this man staggering around. They take him in and try to help him because they were taught first aid during the war, and then slowly finding out that he's a wanted fugitive and trying to overcome that dilemma of how can they help him and yet not become involved. And that's a beautifully written little vignette. There are a whole bunch of these little character vignettes in the film. There's a bit where one of the men who finds out where Johnny is hiding. He's a drunken guy who has budgerigars. And he goes to the priest, and Kathleen's at the priest, is there with the priest. And he starts talking about how very special his budgerigar is. And the budgerigar's name is Johnny. And the budgerigar has got into trouble. And he's using this as an analogy to try to get money out of the priest for turning in Johnny. Because there's £1,000 bounty out on his head. And £1,000 in those days might have been a year or two's wages. It's an immense amount of money for these people. And time after time during the film, you find that bounty coming up against what people know is right. And the fact that the people are poor and that there is rationing and things like that. And yet there's this carrot on the stick in front of them of turning this man in. They know he's going to be killed because he's murdered somebody, so obviously he's going to be executed by the law. So there's that emotional conflict between various characters, between I desperately need this money to improve my life, but if I turn this man in, he's going to be killed by the authorities. And maybe to some extent, I believe in the cause that he's fighting for. So there are all these different undercurrents of character and character needs and character traits and character beliefs as well, because there is a priest, a sympathetic priest involved, who I get offended by a lot of religious talking movies, to be honest with you. But this priest in this film doesn't offend my sensibilities because his first concern is compassion. And I think that that's where I kind of draw the line. I can accept this guy's a priest and he has all these kind of supernatural beliefs and things like that. But his first concern is compassion for people in need. And I think that that's definitely a subtle line to draw, and a line that's drawn extremely well by the writing of this movie. It really does make it more accessible and more acceptable to me. And yes, I've got my own prejudices and beliefs, and I find heavy-handed religiosity in movies very off-putting. I find it too kind of authorial. The author's trying to set their agenda and push their agenda a little bit. And that doesn't occur in this film. I mean, I don't suppose you could make a movie set in the 1940s in Northern Ireland without having a priest or some kind of acknowledgement of the religious climate in the place. And I think that in this film it's done very well, and it's done with an incredibly deft hand. The writing in this film is fantastic, and the acting in this film really is, with that exception of Robert Newton, who was a notorious flamboyant actor and drunkard, he draws attention to himself. But I think every other character in the film, including James Mason, who is exceptionally good, this is the best role James Mason ever did, bar none. I think that he's the one that draws attention to himself. Everybody else draws attention to their character. And I think that's a useful way to evaluate films, I suppose. Is the person drawing attention to the actor, or is the person drawing attention to the character? So, I'm kind of happy with that one. I just thought of it, but I'm really happy with that as an analysis tool and a question to ask when you're watching films. Because I think that there are times when, I mean, I'll give you a modern example. George Clooney in The American. He doesn't draw attention to himself as George Clooney as the actor. He draws attention to himself as the character he is playing, the American. that kind of thing, where I think there can be stars who do their job like actors, and there are actors who do their job like stars, and there are stars who do their job like stars. But I think James Mason and all the other actors in this film serve the story really, really well. And Carol Reed, of course, directed The Third Man, and he did a version of Oliver Twist and a number of other things like that. And the black and white photography in all of Carol Reed's films, that are in black and white, of course, are exceptional. Let me see if I can find, refresh myself on Carol Reed's filmography, because there's some interesting movies in there, and some of them I may want to do in a future podcast. He was born in 1986 and died in 1976. Let's see, we've got, let me go through here. He did Oliver in 1968, a movie that I hate. Did The Agony, The Ecstasy, Mutiny on the Bounty, Our Men in Havana. Let's see what I've got there. The Third Man, of course. Outcast of the Islands, interesting little film. A Kid for Two Farthings. Trapeze with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. I've forgotten that he'd done that. Our Man, as I said, Our Man in Havana. Yeah, so he had a very fine filmography. And really, I've got to do The Third Man. I've decided this. I've really got to do The Third Man for a future podcast, because there's so much to say about that film. Some of it's been said, but it's one of those films I really do feel the need to really enjoy in your company, of course. I'm dithering now. So I apologize for this. I kind of suddenly looked at the Wikipedia page, and I'm getting involved in reading about Carol Reed when I should be podcasting. So I apologize for that. So anyway, Odd Man Out. I'll play the second bit of audio from the film, which is Kathleen talking to the policeman, who's not an unsympathetic character. And it just gives her viewpoint as well, which I think is well enunciated in the film, in this scene, when she's talking with her grandmother, in a very interesting little scene there, and also when she's talking to the priest about Johnny and how deep her feelings are for him. Hers is a tragic role, but it's a very, very interesting one.
It was about Johnny.
I can tell you nothing.
You were making plans how you could find him. That's the truth now, isn't it?
What do you want in this house?
He has gone too far this time for any of you to help him.
Finish your work here and get out and leave us in peace.
We're not after him for taking a shot at us, or for blowing out the windows of a police barracks with explosives. This time, he has shot and killed a man. You know what that means.
It's his concern.
And yours.
I'm not responsible for him.
You're responsible for what goes on in this house. Now, I warn you, if there's any evidence found here, it will go very hard with you, unless you help us now.
What do you want me to say?
I want the truth, that's all.
I want to know where Johnny is.
Mm-hmm.
Odd Man Out is one of those movies, like The Third Man and like a lot of other films that I really treasure, that I won't watch very often, because if I watch it too often, the emotional impact and the story won't carry me along. It's one of those things where if every day you stood staring at the Mona Lisa for an hour, you'd kind of get bored with it after a while. But if you see it very occasionally and very rarely, you get that wow factor. And this is one of those films for me. I haven't seen it in a couple of years, and I rewatched it again, and the story carried me along. There are so many little character vignettes that really are gems of cinema. There's a little piece where Johnny's hiding in the back of the air raid shelter, and a young boy and a young girl come in to get some privacy, and just the dialogue between them and the way they the two actors kind of move, and the way they're standing in respect to each other, really is a lovely little piece of work. And they do at one stage realize that Johnny's there, and little tryst ends. But it's a really great little piece of work, and it gives minor actors a chance to shine. It gives them an opportunity to show what they can do, and to carry along the story. The story is not carried by the bits where James Mason is silent or passed out for a chunk of the movie, and the other actors and the other characters carry the story for a period of time, and not a short period of time either. There's got to be 20 minutes in straight in there where Johnny is just passed out in various places while other people work around him. And I find that really a lovely way to make a film, and a generous way to make a film. It's generous towards the other actors and lets them carry the story. It's not a way Hollywood works nowadays, where if you've got a star in a film, you've got to have the star there most of the time. This movie doesn't feel that need and doesn't suffer from that constraint. So really, from comparing it to a modern film is a really interesting exercise, and it does in some ways show us some of the things we've lost by having celebrity gods acting in films. So that's about all I really want to say about Odd Man Out. If you haven't seen it, you've got something to look forward to. It really is a fantastic piece of cinema, and a very humane piece of cinema, which I like too. I like films that reinforce my better views of humanity, and I think that this one does, even though there are criminals in it, even though there are what we now call terrorists in it. There's a generosity of spirit in this movie that I really think is something that you can't state too often. So I'm going to take another break now, and then we're going to get into the feedback from other generous and very humane people around the place.
It's the motion that makes your mama wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that kids hit the sock. Well, I had a man, he was awful thin. Not much to him but bones and skin. But one thing about him I could understand. He wraps all around me like a rubber band. It ain't the meat, it's the motion that makes your mama wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gives it the sock. The harder they fall. It ain't the meat, it's the motion that makes your mama wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gives it the sock. The motion. It's the movement. It's the action. It's the movement that gives it the sock. Well, I had a boy living down the street, kinda young but awful sweet. And when he starts rocking me, he don't wanna stop. It makes this mama wanna blow her top. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. Makes your mama wanna rock. It ain't the meat, it's the motion. It's the movement that gives it the side.
That was Maria Maldar singing It Ain't the Meat, It's the Motion, a very old blues song. And I've now got the cats with me at the moment. Jack's on a bookshelf here. Jill's trying to hassle him. And it looks like if you hear loud screeching, that is not me. That is the two cats wrestling. They're now playing around. They've decided they wanted to come and keep me company at the moment. But anyway, on to the feedback. And as I said, we've got at least four or five bits of feedback, which is always gratifying to get. And I think we'll start off with the usual suspects, being, in this case, Dr. Zom.
Hey, Paleo Cinema. This is Dr. Zom. Kind of a in a somber mood today, as I just found out that one of my all-time favorite directors, Sidney Lumet, passed away. And I just wanted to call and basically, you know, mention some of his movies that, you know, which there are so many. I mean, it's almost impossible to mention, you know, all of them, but you know, some of the ones that really stick out in my mind that that he did. And I've talked before a couple of times, you know, on feedback with you guys about his work with Sean Connery, The Hill and The Offense were two movies that I discovered when there wasn't any internet, and we would get a giant catalog that had VHS tapes that you could buy. And I picked these two up because, you know, being a fan of James Bond, I had never heard of them. And I thought, well, you know, hey, this is pretty cool. And I got both movies, and I was just blown away by both movies and by the performance of Connery, and just two really great movies, and two movies that are completely and totally different than anything he had ever done. Another one that I picked up not that long ago was at Walmart in the bargain bin for like $5, was The Verdict with Paul Newman. Excellent movie, just everything about it, top to bottom. I just love that movie, the way it was shot. I even listened to Lumet, his commentary on the DVD, and it was just, it's something that everyone should, if you get a chance to listen to. And he explains, you know, his choice of colors and how he shot the movie and what he was going for, and it's just really fascinating to listen to. One that kind of, I don't know if I would say it's fallen through the cracks, because Lumet was involved with or directed the movie Serpico, which is the more famous movie that's kind of lasted longer with Al Pacino, which was also a great, great movie and a favorite of mine as a kid. You know, I really looked up to the character of Serpico. I liked, you know, how he shot, you know, the entire movie. Just really well done movie. But the other one, which is kind of related to or linked to that movie, would be Prince of the City with Treat Williams and Jerry Orbach. Excellent movie. It is a nice tie-in with Serpico, with American Gangster, and with French Connection, because it all had to do with that period of time and with those cops who were involved in a lot of the corruption and stuff that was going on at that time. Just a really, really, really good movie. I don't want to babble on too much because, like I said, Lumet had so many great movies that it would, you could sit here all day and, you know, talk about what he did, 12 Angry Men. You know, how could you leave that one out? I mean, but I just wanted to say, you know, Sidney Lumet, you know, is a great director, probably between him and John Frankenheimer, my two favorite directors. And I hate to see him go, but, you know, he's left a filmography that is just outstanding, that will, you know, live forever. His work, you know, speaks for itself, and there's nobody that can take anything away from him. So I just want to say rest in peace, Sidney Lumet, and, you know, Hate to see you go. Paleo Cinema, this is Dr. Zom. Like I said, being a little bit somber this week, not too much, you know, not feeling too funny, but, you know. Anyway, we'll get back to that later. Talk to you later, Terry, Sally, Jack, Jill. Zom out.
Thanks for that, Zom. I don't care what mood you're in, mate. You offered great feedback. And, yes, yeah, Sizzling the Met, I've got my little list going, as you know. And one of the things I'm going to do is rewatch The Hill. I don't have a copy of it on video, but I can acquire a copy, if you know what I mean. I think I will do. It's one of those things that I know how good a film is, and you get inundated with so much media these days. And it's self-inflicted. I'm not trying to pretend it's not. But I do want to see that. I think I should watch 12 Angry Men again as well. I haven't seen Serpico since Jesus was playing Cowboys. And, yeah, I did see it in the cinemas. It was one of the first grown-ups movies that I recall seeing by myself going to the cinema, being as ancient as I am. I did go and see Cabaret, and I did go and see Serpico at the cinemas. When I wasn't watching exploitation movies like The Ginger Series starring Sherry Cafaro and any blaxploitation movies that I could find. But anyway, thanks for that, Zom, and please keep up the good work. One of the things I should mention too is that I'm on my Facebook page, I'm doing the 30-day cinema challenge, where they have 30 different questions. You've got to do your best film, the worst film, the film that reminds you of people, the film that reminds you of places, that kind of thing. And I'm about six or seven days into the 30-day film challenge at the moment, and I like it. I'm not sure how I'm going to answer some of the film a day things. There's one question about, you know, what's your favorite film, what's your not least favorite film over the 30 days. There's a couple of them I'm going to be stretching myself to answer, but I kind of like it, and it's a way of adding content to the Facebook page. So pop over there and do that, and if you want to take it up yourself, it's an interesting little exercise to do. And I'm always interested to read which films other people have certain opinions about. So I'm doing a bit of that there. And Zom, you should try that, mate. Absolutely. And anybody else, Rupert, the rest of you guys. Did get a Facebook message as well, speaking of Facebook, from Marty Cook, who's in Adelaide and is a great supporter of the podcast. He says, excellent podcast on Universal Monsters. Frankenstein is amazing. I only saw Dracula for the first time last week. Good but not great. Definitely flawed. I enjoyed weird stuff like the armadillos, but I agree the ending was very anticlimactic. Still glad to see it. Marty. Thanks for that, Marty. Yeah, it's a weird film, Dracula. I'm sure it scared the shit out of people at the time it was made, but it's one of those ones that hasn't aged as well as Frankenstein has. Frankenstein, and of course, possibly because of James Whale's theatrical background, really does work a lot better from our viewpoint. And I've got to consider that it is our viewpoint. It's not everybody's. It's a viewpoint from the second decade of the 21st century. So it's really one of those things that, unfortunately, I would have loved to have enjoyed Dracula a lot more than I did. But that's the way it goes with these things sometimes. Okay, well, on to the next bit of feedback. I did get an email from a filmmaker called David Guglielmo. About, he's got a short film called Damn Your Eyes, a spaghetti western influenced revenge flick that he thinks that people on the website might enjoy. I'm going to post a link to it on the Paleo Cinema, paleocinema.blogspot.com website. See, the mouth's going late in the podcast. There's a link to the Vimeo of the short film. And he says, if you like it and decide to feature it in your site, let him know. So I'm going to put it on the site. But thank you for that, David. Really appreciate any links like that. I'll definitely post them up and steer people in your direction. So that'll be on the show notes for this podcast. So we'll do that. And all the best to your future efforts. And short films are great. And they're so accessible through 21st century means. And I think they're also a good way of starting the career. So really hope you do well with that, mate. And on to the next bit of voicemail. This one's from Rupert over at Rupert Pupkin Speaks at Blogspot. Here it is.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just listening to your latest show. I'm listening to you talk about Dracula. I have to say, I appreciate that you're being so kind about the quote-unquote heresy of saying Dracula isn't that interesting a movie, but I'm totally with you, man. I think it's by far the weakest of the Universal horror films. I love Bela Lugosi. In fact, I love the story sort of his life, as sad as it is. And I don't know, he's a good actor, and but I think he's better in other films. I mean, not better. I mean, I guess he's been in better films is what I mean. You know, I understand you're being, trying to be kind to those that are huge Dracula fans, and it was this seminal work, but looking at it as a film, I totally agree with a lot of what you're saying, and it's to me, like you said, just one of the least interesting of that group. I don't know. I really like Frankenstein, obviously, is great. Bride of Frankenstein, great. Wolfman is good. I'm a big fan of The Invisible Man. I think that is a really interesting and dark, very dark film, kind of sadistic for that period, I find. I like the whole Invisible Man series. I think there's a lot of fun film. None that rival the first film, but like even, I think Return of with Vincent Price is pretty solid for me. It's got some fun moments and whatnot. Anyway, just digging the show. Just wanted to give my 2 cents. I don't think you should worry too much about bagging on Dracula. It hasn't aged as well as the others, which is, you know, too bad. Anyway, good stuff.
Rupert then sent a second voicemail.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert again. Sorry. I was just thinking, I know you covered your requisite 30s films in this Universal group, but should you ever want to venture into that territory again, I would love to hear you cover the film One Way Passage with it's a Tay Garnett film with William Powell and Kay Francis. Some might find it sad, but I think it's a romantic film that I really like. It was unavailable on DVD for a long time. I just recently discovered that Warner Archives has put it out, and I went ahead and ordered that right up, as it's sort of a favorite of mine. Also, I was going to say, I feel like you've covered some Marx Brothers movies at some point, but would love to hear you talk about either Animal Crackers or Horse Feathers, perhaps. Any of them, if you haven't. I just can't remember if you've covered them. Those are great 30s comedies, obviously, too. Same thing with Design for Living, you know. And I'm just going to go on and on with 30s movies. But anyway, I know that I'd love to hear you cover any of that stuff. Anyway, that's all I got. Sorry. Okay, bye.
Thanks, Rupert. I'll talk about the first voicemail first. Yeah, Dracula. I agree. The Invisible Man is a really interesting one too, with Claude Rains' voice in it. Yeah, it is very dark as well. It's a little linked up in my mind with Amazon Women on the Moon, when they had Egg Begley Jr. playing the son of the Invisible Man, and which is one of the funniest pastiches in the history of cinema, from my point of view. But yeah, I agree. The Invisible Man, very interesting universe. One, I'm not dismissing the possibility of dipping into other Universal horror films from that era. And if I did, Invisible Man would be right up there. I may even, at some stage, take a squiz at Creature from the Black Lagoon, which is another interesting one. I know that B-MovieCast, amongst other podcasts, has already done it, but I think that doing the three that I've done of the Universal horror films has given me the confidence to cover things other people have covered, because I could bring my perspective to them. And which isn't to say I disrespect anyone else's perspective, but I've really got to look through the source material and all the material about these films that's out there, and then put it aside a little bit and come at the movie fresh, which is a little hard to do at times, but I do like the discipline of doing that. I do like the idea of having a shitload of information at hand about a movie, but putting it in a little box and then trying to come at the movie fresh and then talking about what I perceived of the film directly. So I'm going to do a little more of that. Marx Brothers, I'm going to do a Marx Brothers film. I've got a project. Well, I might as well mention it now. I've got a project I'm going to do over the next 13 podcasts with maybe a movie, maybe a music podcast in between. I'm going to do an A to Z. So basically, the next podcast I do is going to be a movie that's title starts with A and B. Next one's C and D. Next one, ENF, etc. And maybe the D should be Duck Soup. I think I might kind of lock that one in to be Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers film. So that I can cover off. I haven't covered off the Marx Brothers before. I really should. And I love the writing of people like S.J. Perelman, who wrote for the Marx Brothers. I've got an omnibus edition of S.J. Perelman's writings, and it is pissing yourself funny to read his stuff. And so I will do that. I'm locking in the D to be Duck Soup. But the reason I'm doing the A to Z, I should mention, is one of the other e-books I got for my new little Kindle is another one of David Thompson's reference books. It's a book called Have You Seen, which is 500-word essays of 1,000 classic films that David Thompson's seen. He's my favourite film critic who's still got a pulse. I like Ebert stuff. I disagree with Ebert a little too much. But I've got a lot of respect for David Thompson as a writer. And so I picked up two of his e-books. The first, of course, being the fifth edition of the New Biographical Dictionary of Film. And the second one being Have You Seen? And I've read through all of the essays in Have You Seen voraciously. There are movies there that I'd love to cover the podcast. There are a lot of movies in there that I have covered for the podcast. And there are movies there that I haven't seen, but based on these short essays that Thompson has written about them, I'm going to see. So I'm going to have to annotate. And the lovely thing about the Kindle is I can leave bookmarks and annotate the text. I'm going to annotate them so that I can read or watch the movies that are mentioned in that book. And I recommend that people pick it up. It's a really interesting book, particularly for our kind of movie buff. So that's the reason why I'm doing an A to Z. So next podcast, number 75, starts the A to Z project. So I've got a lot of space to play with in there. I've figured out the hard ones like the X's and the Z's. I've got that covered. I haven't seen One Way Passage. I have picked up a copy of it, so it's in my thumb drive at the moment to watch. And if I don't do a podcast about One Way Passage, I'll at least mention in the podcast what I thought of it, and if I recommend it or not. I believe I will, because I've just taken a look at the synopsis of it, and it definitely looks like our kind of stuff. Yeah, I should do more 1930s. Comedies and things. I want to do, and I think it's from, is it 30s or 40s? I think it might be 41. I want to do The Lady Eve as one of them. I also want to maybe do Palm Beach Story and things like that. But really going to enjoy what I'm doing. I did get an email from Morris Brzezinski. It says, "Hello Terry, it's great to hear a new show after your holiday and interested to hear your take on the Universal horror flicks. I only ever seen Dracula out of the three, although my 13-year-old son has watched Frankenstein and agrees it's a better film. I don't know if you had a chance to look up ways of tracking down the film I mentioned in the last note to you, The Thorn, aka The Divine Mr. J, but here's another one for you. Recently I bought a copy of The Bicycle Thief, a film I've long loved, and recall that Maurizio Nicchetti parody, The Icicle Thief. If you've not seen it, it's the sort of Bicycle Thief meets Purple Rose of Cairo. It's a fantastic film, but isn't available officially on DVD, or is it? Do you know, or any of your listeners know? I'd be grateful for any advice. Looking forward to hearing more shows, including the ongoing commentary from Dr. Zom. Cheers, Morris." Thanks for that, Morris. Yeah, I have tracked down The Thorn, and I'm going to be in touch with you about that one, but I'll have to track down The Icicle Thief now. I like a challenge, and I'll see what I can find out for you. So thanks for the feedback, and I'm glad your son agrees with me. He's obviously a kid of impeccable taste. And Frankenstein, definitely better. Get him to try The Wolfman, and as suggested by other feedback, maybe The Invisible Man.
Hey, this is Richard from Wichita. Don't want to leave a long message here. Just want to say fantastic job on your review of Dracula, Frankenstein, and The Wolfman. I wasn't sure going into it, because I know those films have been done kind of ad nauseum, but you know what? You threw some facts and figures out that I hadn't heard before. And you did a real interesting review on it. I actually really enjoyed the episode. I was, like I said, I was trepidatious going in, but you proof positive that you can take a movie that probably everyone on the planet has seen and still do a different take on it, because I think everyone's got a different opinion on the movies. I have to admit, though, I am kind of in tune with what you're saying. I always personally thought that the Spanish version of Dracula was a superior film over you know, the, I guess, the Lugosi version. It would have been interesting to maybe put Lugosi in the Spanish version to see, you know, how that would have, that pairing would have worked. But anyway, it was interesting to hear you talk about that. I also personally think Frankenstein is the best of those three films. And I had some of the same queries about The Wolfman. Although I love The Wolfman, I think I like it a little bit more than you. I've always kind of wondered about Lon Chaney and Claude Rains. I was like, yeah, they're very different. Lon Chaney seemed a little lost, but then again, maybe that's why he left town. He just didn't fit in. I don't know. But yeah, three classic films. I enjoy all three. Yeah, enjoyed listening to what you have to say. And as always, take care. We'll talk to you soon. Hey, this is Richard from Wichita again. A quick P.S. Wanted to let you know that I got a copy of Madam Sin. Based on your discussion of this film a while back, you know, with Betty Davis, Robert Wagner, I've been kind of looking for it. A little hard film to find, at least here in the States, because it hasn't been released officially on DVD. And sure enough, it's popped up on iTunes, of all places. iTunes kind of tends to surprise me sometimes. They throw some of the Warner Brothers Archive movies that we have over here. Those tend to pop up on iTunes sometimes. And every now and then you get a film that just, you know, isn't officially been released on DVD. The Hammer film, for example, The Brigand of Kandahar. I picked that up a while ago on iTunes. Random searching, I found it. And that's how I found Madam Sin. Did random searching for what was out there in Hammer. Found the movie Crescendo, which is a Warner Brothers Archive film. And one of the recommendations, you know, if you like Crescendo, recommended Madam Sin. And I thought, fantastic. I wouldn't have even thought to look there for it. Haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I burned a DVD off the off of iTunes. So it's on my incredibly large stack to watch. But I look forward to it. It's kind of towards the top based on your recent review of it. So, or maybe not so recent by now. Anyway, again, thanks for everything you do with the show. Take care. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Richard. I hope you enjoyed Madam Sin. It's one of those silly little films, and it's kind of crosses over the Fu Manchu genre with the spy genre pretty well, and I always like Robert Wagner being suave. So, yeah, glad you were able to find a copy of it. I hope everybody else can hip to that and maybe find it on iTunes. And while you're there, give Paleo Cinema a review. It never hurts to have one. So, yeah, I kind of agree. The Frankenstein is the best of the three for me. I know you're more fond of The Wolfman, but Frankenstein really kind of worked. And Bride of Frankenstein I like as well for the campiness of it. And Ernest Thesinger and things like that. But anyway, that's about it for this time around on the podcast. Thank everybody for the feedback. I always like it. I also got a verbal feedback from my old mate Twitch at work. He listened to the Frankenstein, Wolfman and Dracula one while he was stuck on a train, and it got him through the entire trip even though the trains were delayed. So Twitch, this one's for you, mate. Anyway, next time around I'm going to start the A to Z project. Pretty much know which movies I'm going to start out with, which is never a bad place to be. I am using Have You Seen as a major reference point for this project. I'm not going to strictly stick to it. There are going to be things that jump out from elsewhere, but it's a good overall reference, and there are some films mentioned in that book that I really want to talk about and put my own spin on. He's got 500 words to do it in. I've got an hour plus for the podcast, and the podcast do seem to be getting longer, which I don't mind that much. But anyway, I'm off tonight to have dinner with friends for my birthday, and then be self-indulgent with Sal tomorrow, and then be self-indulgent by myself on Monday, because I've got Monday off as well. I'm probably going to go see Paul, the Simon Pegg Nick Frost movie, and a couple of other films if I can cram them in at the cinema. Haven't been to the cinema for a while. I've been watching a lot of things on the TV, but I'll let you know how that goes. So everybody take care of yourselves. Email cultguru@gmail.com. Vote for me at Podcast Alley if you choose to. Put a review at iTunes. The blogs at paleo-cinema.blogspot.com, and on Thursday nights, my time, I'm talking about movies with Ivor Cole on ABC local radio in the Northern Territory. Anyway, that's about it. Everybody take care. Sal and the cats say hi, and look after yourselves, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you.